From Jewish extremists to Jewish Arab reconciliation to Iran to your Jewish calls, we've got you covered today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, let me tell you what happened. A little bit earlier today, I recorded, maybe 2 hours ago, I recorded those words you just heard, from Jewish extremists to Arab-Jewish reconciliation, etc., speaking about something that happened a few days back as two Israelis, ultra-Orthodox Jews, were charged in an arson attack on the Church of Loaves and Fishes, a historic Christian site in Israel. That's what I was referring to. But since then, there is news that, broke just not that long ago, within the last half hour or hour, I would say, thereabouts, about a Jewish extremist who allegedly stabbed six at a gay pride parade in Jerusalem. According to the reports, it was a man who engaged in a stabbing attack in 2005 and just got out of jail. An ultra-Orthodox Jew. We'll talk about that honestly today on The Line of Fire. A whole lot of things we want to cover. Some good news as well. This is Michael Brown. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. The way things work is simple. If you have a Jewish-related question or comment, Hebrew-related, Judaism-related, Israel, Middle East-related, even Islamic-related, although I can't answer all Islamic-related questions, but many we can. By all means, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. If you're a Jewish listener and you don't agree with me about Jesus, Yeshua, sometimes we're able to take calls and have many discussion, many debates on the air as well. But I want to address one particular group. First, let me categorically denounce the violence in Jerusalem. As much as I deplore the idea of a gay pride parade in the city of Jerusalem for many obvious reasons, I deplore all the more a violent attack on marchers, stabbing people in cold blood in broad daylight as if it was doing God's work. I deplore that and renounce that. We'll come back to that. But I just want to address one group of people, and I don't know how many of you are listening right now that fit in this group, fit in this category. It might be one, it might be 100, might be none. But you would be a Jew who is technically off the derech. You would be a Jew who was raised in an ultra-Orthodox home, a from home, perhaps a Haredi home, Hasidic home. And you have since abandoned your ultra-Orthodox upbringing. I just read a very poignant story from yet another young man who is off the derech. And then was it just a few days ago, last week, tragic story of a woman who was raised ultra-Orthodox and then killed herself, she left her community and then subsequently killed herself. Maybe you're listening to me and you miss some of the spirituality you once had. You miss that sense of faith in God and connection to God that you once had. But you can't go back to your old traditional way. You can't go back to what for you is a very legalistic way. You can't go back to living the way you lived. So the only other alternative is basically being secular. There's another alternative, and that's to find spirituality in Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. You say, what in the world are you talking about? Ah, he said, come to me, all you who are burdened down and weary. And in context, he was talking about those who are burdened down and wearied by traditional religion. He said, come to me and find rest. I'm not talking about the God of the Catholic Church. I'm not talking about some pagan deity. I'm talking about our Mashiach, Yeshua, whom we've rejected and misunderstood for two millennia. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Hey, Joey, you can just grab any of those music clips that you like. You can have your fun today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday and lead in some of these upcoming segments. All right. Our faithful producer, Matt, on vacation, pseudo vacation. He's always working this week. And we'll let Joey pick some of these lead in clips. I know you've been waiting for that opportunity, Joey, for many, many years. So you got it today. 866-34-TRUTH. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. So if you missed the news, yes, annual Gay Pride event in Jerusalem. To me, it's tragic that it takes place there in Jerusalem, which is one of the more religious cities, really the most religious city in certain ways in Israel. You have smaller ones that are very religious. But with all of the history and the ancient temple being there and the remains of the outside wall, the so-called Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, the Kotel still there, and a large percentage of religious Jews and other religious peoples, Christians and Muslims in Jerusalem, it really is a provocation. But it is absolutely wrong. I'm looking at the picture here. There is no possible excuse or justification for this, and I categorically renounce it. Here is an ultra-Orthodox Jew, by the reports, the suspected stabber, Yishai Schlissel, a Haredi, which means ultra-Orthodox man from Modi'in Elite. He stabbed three participants in the 2005 Gay Pride March, recently released from prison after serving 10 years. And what does he do? He immediately goes back and stabs again, at least one seriously wounded. After his release, according to these reports, he returned to his hometown, where residents said that he distributed handwritten pamphlets in which he called on all Jews faithful to God to risk beatings and imprisonment for the sake of preventing the parade. I fully understand the Orthodox Jewish sentiments that say this is an outrage. As followers of Jesus, we say this is an outrage. Traditional Christians from other denominations say it's an outrage. Religious Muslims and others say it's an outrage. But you do not decide to take the law in your own hands and go even further and become a vigilante and attack and attempt to kill. His obvious desire was to attempt to kill, and he thought he was doing God's will. Now, here's the problem. There are very, very devoted rabbis who are ultra-Orthodox Jews. They live lives that are extremely ethical. And to the best of their human ability, they are fearing God and seeking to please him. Obviously, you know my position and view. They need the Messiah. They fall short. They need redemption. They need a Redeemer. They need forgiveness of their sins. And that can only come through Jesus, the Messiah. But I'm talking about people that would be some of the most ethical people you'd ever meet. From a human perspective, some of the most godly people you'd ever meet. Obviously fallen without the true grace of God, but you understand what I'm saying. Seeking to live by the commandments of God, not lifting their finger to hurt a fly, devoted to their families, and studying Torah and rabbinic literature day and night, and living in a very sacrificial lifestyle so as to be generous to the poor. There are people like that, and there are plenty of families of religious Jews that are not fanatical in this way, that have great families, that if you talk to about spiritual things, you'd find a lot of harmony on many, many points. No question. At the same time, there is fanaticism. At the same time, there is not a mentality of we will fight this through prayer alone, or we will take a stand and we will get people to vote, or we'll simply be there in a loving way declaring our differences. No, there is fanaticism. And there are many who are fanatical that if they were given orders by their leader, and there are some fanatical leaders, an Orthodox rabbi, I won't quote him because he didn't say he wanted to be quoted, and it's not Rabbi Shmuley, in case you're trying to figure out who I'm talking about, but a respected Orthodox rabbi in America told me that in his view, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish leaders in Israel were similar to radical Muslim leaders in Islam in terms of extreme legalism, in terms of spiritual extremism and religious extremism. Now, he didn't compare the violence, but he did compare the mentalities. I don't know what he'd say about the violence. There is fanaticism. I have no question whatsoever that if some ultra-Orthodox rabbis in Israel were to give the order to their people to physically attack Jewish believers in Jesus, that they would do it. I don't question it. I don't question that if some of them gave an order to confiscate New Testaments and burn them, they would do it. In fact, it happened not that long ago where that was done, where there was an outreach in one Jewish community, perhaps especially among Ethiopian Jews, I forget if that's accurate, and New Testaments were given out and ultra-Orthodox Jews confiscated them and burned them. And many Israelis were outraged, saying, Hitler burned our books. You don't go burning people's books because you don't agree with it. Hitler burned our books. Jews don't burn books. So there was national outrage in many circles over it. I don't doubt that if in certain groups, the lead rabbi gave an edict and said you were to go there and physically attack people at the gay pride parade, they would do it. The fact is, they're not giving these edicts. The fact is, they are not saying go and do physical harm, because for most of them, that would be an ethical violation. That would be a wrong violation. Now, if there was a fully reconstituted Sanhedrin, there is a group of Jewish leaders that calls itself a Sanhedrin but does not have national authority over Israel. Let's say that Israel, instead of being led democratically, was ultimately led by ultra-Orthodox Jews with a Sanhedrin. I imagine that you could well see the death penalty for apostasy again, alleged apostasy. That if someone like me was, quote, missionizing in Israel and seeking to bring Jewish people to faith in Jesus the Messiah, that you could see that reconstituted. An ultra-Orthodox rabbi told me many years ago on Long Island that if we were living in the days of the Second Temple, I would be put to death by having molten lead poured down my throat. That's what he actually said. So I believe some of them would gladly see that penalty, or certainly for someone who was raised an Orthodox Jew and then turned away from that and sought to bring Jewish people to faith in Jesus. That is not the situation. That is not the political situation that is here right now in Israel. But there are individual fanatics who will do these kinds of things. There are individual fanatics who will do these kinds of things, and they must be renounced. The second principle in my new book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, which will be out September 8th, it's available for pre-order now, but will be coming out September 8th. My second principle in the book is that if we're to outlast the gay revolution, we must take the highest moral ground. We must take the highest moral ground if we are to outlast the gay revolution. Hatred cannot drive out hatred. Martin Luther King famously said that. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Just like with the pro-life movement. If you're pro-life, then you don't murder an abortion doctor, even though what the doctor is doing is wrong. If you stand for morality, then you don't stab someone participating in a gay pride event, however much you reject and renounce the event. So there is a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things. Someone posted this unfortunate, somewhat idiotic, well, more than idiotic, libelous post, a review of my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian? Now, there are negative reviews that are going to be on there. If someone reads the book and they differ with it, have at it. You're going to always have negative reviews. And there are people who won't read the book, but at least will post a semblance of a review. But this one posted a review, and it said, I have blood on my hands, and my book is like Mein Kampf, and I'm part of this ex-gay movement that's led to thousands of deaths and suicides. Of course, anyone who read the book would say, what in the world is that person talking about? And anyone who read the book knows the one thing you can't attack it for is lack of compassion, lack of sensitivity. You may disagree with my conclusions, but you cannot attack it for lack of sensitivity, lack of compassion, beginning on the very first page and the very first chapter. I've had readers tell me they were in tears, Christians, for those who identified as gay Christian as they read the first chapter, that their eyes were finally open to those struggles. My position is consistently, we must take the highest moral ground. Yes, I will absolutely not celebrate, quote, Caitlyn Jenner, or I will not celebrate the Supreme Court's redefining of marriage, and I will say that there are things that are very wrong. And yes, I'll say that gay activism is the principal threat to religious freedom, speech, and conscience in America today. Freedom of speech, religion, and conscience in America. That being said, how do we stand against the tide of gay activism? With love, with grace, with truth, with patience, with perseverance? All right, we'll be right back. Alan, I want to get to your call first. Stay right there. We'll be right back on The Line of Fire.
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
That Middle Eastern music tells you it is thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, welcome to the broadcast. If you've got a Jewish-related question, by all means, give us a call. I just posted this if you're pro-life or tweeted it. If you're pro-life, you don't murder abortion doctors. If you're pro-morality, you don't stab people at a gay pride march. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Springfield, Virginia. Alan, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Good afternoon, Michael Brown.
Good afternoon.
Hey, the reason I was calling, and this is kind of a side note in regards to witnessing to Jews. The other day I saw on a post, I think it was through Living Waters, and this young man was witnessing to some Jews in Jerusalem. And what he was doing is he was showing them the original language of Isaiah, and he was having them read Isaiah 53. And what was surprising in the interview, every single one of the people that he interviewed and had them read that had never read it before.
And yeah, let me explain the dynamic there. The ministry that put that out, I'm friends with. In fact, it's been a tremendous blessing. They've taken a lot of the material from my five-volume series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, with my permission and blessing, broken it down into little soundbite sections, put out provocative videos, and it's really reaching a lot of Israelis, even religious Jews. So we are absolutely thrilled with the partnership. So here's the deal. A traditional Jew, a very, very traditional Jew, raised in a very Orthodox family, right? A young man, say at the age of 12, knows more of the Hebrew Bible in terms of say, the five books of Moses and some of the Psalms and other passages, knows it in Hebrew better in terms of just memorizing the information and being familiar with it, better than a lot of seminary professors that teach Old Testament. In other words, they are immersed. By the time that kid is 15, he studied more rabbinic literature by that time of his life than I have in my entire life multiplied, okay? They learn an unbelievable amount of material. However, if it's not in their system of study, they're not going to read it. So, for example, they learn the Torah cold because they read it every week in the synagogue, right?
Right.
You know, and they study it through the week. They learn portions of the Talmud and the law codes cold because they study them growing up. They also know certain portions of Scripture really, really well because they pray them every day in the prayer book, Psalms and other passages. Or there are portions of the prophetic books and the historical books that they also read in the synagogue. But it's not like we just read the Bible cover to cover. What it is in the synagogue, you've got what's called the Torah and the Haftarah. The Haftarah is a supplemental reading. And you may know this, but I'm explaining it for the benefit of other listeners as well. So let's say you're reading the weekly section is, you know, the first five and change chapters of Genesis, right? And then along with that, you're reading a corresponding section. It could be from the one of the prophetic books or historical book, and that's called the Haftarah. So when it comes to Isaiah 53, that's one of the chapters that is not included in one of the Haftarah readings. You say, well, that's not a big deal because lots of chapters are not included. True, The issue is the chapter before it is included and the chapter after it is included, and that one skipped. Right. Now, why is it skipped? There is one ancient synagogue tradition that seems to indicate it used to be read, but then got pulled because it was constantly used by followers of Jesus to say that's Jesus. There's another tradition from another part of the ancient world that says it was never read. It was skipped because it just didn't fit in with the subject of the readings. So we don't know for sure whether it was pulled or whether it was just skipped. What we do know for sure is this. It's not read regularly by religious Jews. And unless they're trained in counter-missionary work, they happen to be a rare one that's actually read through the Hebrew Bible cover to cover because that's not their method of study, then they're simply not familiar with it. And if they do read it, they'll read it with the commentaries, which say it refers to the nation of Israel or to the righteous remnant within Israel.
Right. But I just found it very interesting that of all the, I think he must have interviewed at least a dozen people, and none of them had ever read it or heard of it.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if that video is everyone that they interviewed, because, you know, if they interview enough people, they'll run into some who are familiar. But it's an absolute, if it's not everyone, it's certainly a representative sampling. And, Alan, that leads me to a related point. The related point is this, that when you're talking to your average Jew in America, your average Jew in America is not a religious Jew. A good 90% of American Jews are not very Orthodox. That means, as a typical Christian reading your Bible in English, you know the Bible far, far better than that Jewish person. Unless they were raised reading it in Hebrew and studying it for years, or unless it's a rabbi, you know the Bible far better than they do. So rather than being intimidated, you should recognize that you have an advantage there, and you want to sit down and introduce them to things in the Scripture they may not be familiar with. But, Alan, thank you for the call and for bringing that to our attention. And the video is getting a lot of coverage, for which I am grateful. 866-34-TRUTH. One other Jewish extremist report. Two Israelis charged in the attack on Church of Loaves and Fishes. There is a graffiti I'm looking at. They wrote on the wall that the idols will be utterly cut off. The false gods will be utterly cut off. In their view, that refers to Jesus. These were two ultra-Orthodox extremists, age 19 and 20, who believe that only someone who fights against Christianity can call himself a Jew. And obviously, all they know of Christianity is what they've heard through church history and persecutions of Jewish people. However, does that give them the right to attack a historic building or any building? Of course not. God forbid. And most Israelis recoil at this, and it makes Jewish people look bad and religious Jews look bad, even though this was just two extremists. Once again, we utterly renounce the extremism. All right. If you haven't yet downloaded our special teaching this week, we've made 24 hours of teaching available at a really, really low price to download, or you can call to get two CDs to listen to on your computer or your MP3 player. These are MP3 files. 24 hours of teaching I've done on spiritual warfare and angels, demons, and deliverance. You'll notice when you listen, my voice sounds a little different. It's because I did this teaching some years ago. And just like I have books that are 20, 25 years old, we have audio teachings that are that old. But we felt it was the best we ever taught it, the most clearly we ever taught it, and therefore we continue to distribute it. But we've reduced the price radically. What does the Bible really say about these issues? I mean, what about Paul's writing in Ephesians 6 that we're not wrestling with flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers, with demonic powers? What about the call to resist the devil? What about the fact that we are in a battle, but it's a spiritual battle? Call out of order, 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978, or better still, go to my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. You can do the download right from the website. There's a video that'll tell you more.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. 866-34-TRUTH. Welcome to the Line of Fire broadcast. My delight to speak with you. Any Jewish-related questions that you have, any Jewish-related issues you'd like to raise, anything having to do with Israel or the Middle East, by all means, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH. We have several grads who are serving together in northern Iraq right now. And with the crisis with the war in Syria, and then the crisis with the rise of ISIS in Iraq and other regions, in northern Iraq, there are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of refugees pouring in. Muslim refugees, Christian, traditional Christian refugees. And our workers there are having an amazing time sharing the love of God, sharing the gospel with them. Here's a report from our workers in northern Iraq. Water baptisms among Muslims. Many want to meet with us to know about Jesus and what Christians believe. In June, we baptized men from Muslim background, both Kurd and Arab. We had a wonderful celebration service, and believers were touched and stirred to go deeper in their walk with God, and their faith was refreshed to believe for a great harvest among Muslims. A believer from Muslim background that attended was challenged by the commitment to Jesus of those being baptized, to the point that a week after he got baptized himself. And then prayer requests. Pray for these new believers as they face tough challenges being from Muslim background. A young lady from a Muslim family in a refugee camp recently gave her life to Jesus and is so hungry to learn and follow Jesus. She is experiencing much opposition from family members. Her uncle took her Bible from her when he saw her reading it. A necklace with a cross was taken from him. They also took her phone so she cannot communicate with anyone. And recently heard that they want to forcefully marry her to a Muslim man. We ask you to pray for this young woman who truly wants to boldly live for Jesus. Can you imagine that isolation? Can you imagine she's been born again? She knows the truth, but she realizes it could cost her her life, her future, everything. So I don't know her name. I know just what I read to you there. But pray for you, those of you who are prayer warriors, those of you who have prayer lists and pray regularly, by all means, pray for her. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to the phones. Michael in Los Angeles, California, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Brown. Thank you for having me. My question is this. I've been just reading a lot in Leviticus and the Torah and the Law of Moses, and also just, you know, in the back of that, also thinking about what Jesus told to Peter as far as forgiveness. And so I just think that, you know, the way our legal system is, it doesn't really punish people. So I'm all for that, and I'm for things like capital punishment. But at the same time, Peter asked, how many times should I forgive my brother? Seven times, and 70 times seven. So if you can help me or just talk a little bit about the Law of Moses and how to be obedient to that, and as well as having forgiveness, that would help out a great deal.
Yes, sir. And there are several issues that you raise. I want to break them down and take a little while on each one, all right? But let me say first that Jesus does call us deeper than the law does in certain ways. We all know this teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, you've heard this, but I'm saying this. In other words, I'm taking things even further. So for sure, there is an ethic that goes even deeper. While not all parts of the law are applicable to all believers today, and while we are not under the Sinai covenant, we recognize at the same time that there are aspects of the law where Jesus goes further, goes deeper. How do we work those out? I want to try to break that down on the other side of the break. Thank you for the question. Stay right there, Michael.
Change the world.
This is Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, with a shout out to all of our torchbearers. You, our monthly supporters, are the backbone of this ministry, and you keep the line of fire burning bright. To find out, friends, how you can become a torchbearer, go to AskDrBrown.org. Click on Donate.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to the Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish-related answers. So back to Michael in Los Angeles. John 1:17, the law was given by Moses, semicolon, not but semicolon, grace and truth came through Jesus the Messiah. So there is continuum, there is contrast. And we know that we are not under the Sinai law in several ways. We're not under the Sinai covenant. Number one, we're not under the condemnation of the law. There's no death penalty for failure to observe the Sabbath or other sins like that. Sins in ancient Israel that would have been punished with the death penalty in the church are punished with excommunication. For example, if you, in terms of a church answer, not a legal answer. So in ancient Israel, adultery was punished by death. If you're an unrepentant adulterer in the New Testament and claim to be a Christian, you are excommunicated. So we're not under the condemnation of the law. We're not under the law as a system of justification. We are not justified by keeping the law. And we are not under the law as a tutor to bring us to the Messiah. We have been brought to the Messiah. So it's like the scaffolding of a building is no longer needed when the building is up, because now what the scaffolding was forming has been fully formed. So we stand accepted in God's sight by grace, forgiven because of what Jesus has done, and now called to live a life of obedience, called to live a life of holiness. And we learn much about God's ways by studying the law. In other words, we learn in tangible physical ways what God requires spiritually. So all of the laws that were given to Israel regarding separation with food, separation with wearing certain types of clothing, sowing a field with different kinds of seeds, that now tells me in a vivid kind of way that God requires separation. The laws for the priest, you couldn't be a priest if you had any type of physical deformity. God's now calling us to walk with a spiritual purity based on what's written in the law. In other words, we can learn from the law, every word of it, without being fully under it. And then we understand certain aspects of the law have reached their fulfillment in Jesus. For example, the blood sacrifices and things like that. The calendar reaches its fulfillment, past and future, in Jesus. What about forgiveness? Well, the law does say if you find your enemy's oxen wandering, then you have to go and bring it back, even if it's your enemy. That is taught within the Torah. That's a positive value that's taught there. And yet we have a higher example of forgiveness that comes through Jesus, and now a higher example of loving our enemies that comes through the cross. As for the question of capital punishment, that's really something that has to be worked out on a larger level, because capital punishment is something for the society to do. Paul does write in Romans, the 13th chapter, Paul does write that the government has the sword to punish evildoers. So the government may enforce the death penalty for certain things. The question is, can it be rightly enforced? In other words, do we know for sure that this is a guilty party deserving of death? And that's often something that is disputed and discussed. So that's how we come at those things, and then we work out our overall ethic looking at the scriptures as a whole, culminating in the New Testament.
That's perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Brown.
You bet. Yeah, I knew you were listening intently there. My book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices, has a whole section. The last quarter of the book deals with a lot of related issues. You might find it helpful. But thank you, sir, for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Westchester County, New York. Racine, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, hi, how you doing, too?
Doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, so I want to maybe become Jewish, you know, but I'm gay, and I didn't know if that's okay.
Well, let me ask you, Racine, what you mean by becoming Jewish. You mean convert to Judaism?
Yeah.
Uh-huh, and what's your current belief system right now?
I'm not really, I'm not a part of any church or anything now. I just, I believe in God and stuff, you know. But I don't know, you know, so I think I want to be Jewish. I like that too.
What is it that attracts you to wanting to be Jewish?
Chosen people, you know.
Well, chosen people, they're friends of mine. We are Jewish followers of Jesus. You understand that? We're not traditional Jews. We are Jewish followers of Jesus.
So then you're Christians?
We are. If by Christian you understand, it doesn't mean that we stop being Jewish. We are Jewish followers of Jesus. So
well,
some call us.
How do you be both? I don't understand.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have a father? An earthly father?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And does your father have an earthly father? He had a father, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So he's a son and he's a father at the same time, right?
Yeah.
How can you be both?
What are you saying? How can my dad be a son and a father?
Yeah, at the same time. Isn't that contradictory?
No.
Ah, exactly. So if Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, then shouldn't Jews follow him?
Yeah, sure, but then they're Christians, right?
It depends how you define Christian. Many Jews think a Christian is no longer Jewish. Many Jews think a Christian is someone who has renounced faith, is no longer Jewish, and has joined a pagan religion. That's not what we've done. We've put our trust in Jesus as the Jewish Messiah.
Yeah, but that's what Christians do, right?
Well, fine. Christians do that also. Yes, sir. So I can't help you convert to traditional Judaism because I'm not a traditional Jew. And traditional Judaism says that homosexual practice is wrong. You can be attracted to the same sex, but they would tell you that homosexual practice is wrong. And they would discourage you from converting to Judaism unless you were really serious and you would take several years of study before you would be sure about it, and they would be willing to convert you.
But what if I want to be a Christian and still be gay? Can I do that too?
Racine, I'm just curious. You're asking these questions with total sincerity, right?
Yeah, sure.
I got it. Oh, okay. Because there's a certain innocence about your questions, and some people, you know, would be calling to try to just ask a silly question. If you want to follow Jesus, sir, he becomes the Lord of your life. And as the Lord of your life, you now live for him, not for yourself. And if you live for him, you'll be blessed. You'll have eternal life. Your sins will be forgiven. God will be your father. But you will not be able to practice homosexuality. But you can have a wonderfully fulfilled life following the Lord with peace and joy you've never known, with a sense of closeness and intimacy to God that you've never had, with a removal of guilt, with a power to love other people that you've never known, but you won't be able to practice homosexuality. Either you'll be very happy being single, or God will actually change your desires so that you're attracted to the opposite sex. That happens with some people as well.
Yeah, no, not with me. I don't like women.
And no, I understand. You probably never have your whole life, right?
No, I never have. I like.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. How old are you, sir?
I'm 30.
Yeah. Here's the question. If you understand that God has a better way for you, and that the God who created you does not want you to practice homosexuality, would you say, God, whatever you want, just help me? Or would you say, I don't want God, I want to do my own thing? What would you say?
Well, I just, you know, it's the way God made me. I can't help it. What am I supposed to do?
But what about someone who beats you up on the street and says, well, God made me a homophobe. What am I supposed to do? I'm just a violent person. That's the way God made me. That's not an excuse, is it?
No, but that's different than being gay. That's bad. It's a crime.
But it's a sin to be with another man, according to the Bible, according to Jews and Christians. All through the Bible, sir. Well, stay right there, okay? Stay right there.
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, the music tells you it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Look, Rosine could have been totally pulling my leg on each point. Right from the beginning, I had some questions. But just in case he was sincere and ignorant about these different subjects, I wanted to answer him. And even if he wasn't sincere, plenty of others listening can learn from the call. So I took some time with it. I did say I'd speak with him after the break, but he hung up immediately. We went to see our call screener, went to see if he was still there, but he was already gone. Racine, if you're still listening, on the slight chance that there was any sincerity in the call and you weren't just trying to pull my leg with the questions, then by all means, cry out to God and say, God, I want you. I need to get right with you. I need your help. All right? He will help you, but you're going to have to determine you want his will, not yours, and you'll find that his will is better. If it was a prank call, very nicely done, though. Very nicely done, if it was. Either way, I was going to do my best to answer sincerely for the sake of others who were listening, and in case there was sincerity with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Woburn, Massachusetts. Susie, welcome to the line of fire.
Oh, hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about Sicilians and the Jewish people.
Yeah.
I read in my Bible that, I'm not Jewish, by the way. I read in my Bible that the Jewish people did not really like Sicilians because that they would interfere with their culture that God had given them as Jewish people.
You read this in the Bible?
No, my Bible, that was a commentary.
Ah, okay, got
it's
it.
It's NIV Bible by Zondervan.
Okay, study Bible, yep.
Okay,
got
and
it.
I think that's what was trying to say, that because of, you know, the Romans and then the island below Italy, Sicily,
uh-huh,
where my mother was from, that's why I'm calling, because I wanted to know. They tried to avoid the Sicilians because or something would happen if they were associate with the Sicilian people, that they would, their culture would be compromised, their beliefs, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I have no clue what that comment could be referring to.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, I hate
yes
to plead total ignorance there, but I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
What that might be referring to. If you can locate it in your study Bible. Because
okay,
the NIV Study Bible by Zondervan is an excellent tool, a reliable tool, and
okay,
give me some kind of context for it.
All right.
Then, if we see the call, Betsy will make sure we put you right at the top of the list. All right. Even if
okay,
even if you're not listening on the air, if
okay,
we're still on the air, after your show. If you find it, call in, and we'll get right back to you, okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
And then maybe I can help sort it out for you then, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Sure thing.
God bless.
All right. 866-34-TRUTH. Yeah, I'm curious to see what that note is about. Christy in Montgomery, Alabama, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
I have a question. I'm a Christian, and I'm really confused with the term Messianic Jew.
Yeah.
Because I always thought that was a Jewish person who was saved. But there are some people in Montgomery, some congregations that I guess you would call them a Gentile Christian. I'm not really sure how you would even say that, but they're calling themselves Messianic Jews, and I'm so confused. Like, I don't think that's right, but I just wanted to ask your opinion because I go to a Baptist church here, and I just met a couple, and I was wearing Star of David, but she told me she was Messianic, but she didn't look Jewish, so I'm just trying
now,
to
Now, if she
out
said, yeah, yeah, if they said, if these are Gentiles who say they're Messianic Jews, you're not confused. They're confused, okay?
That's what I thought, because I said, right. Well, then are you going to try to obey the Torah? Because you, I mean, I just...
So let me try to explain. Messianic Jew can be used in two ways. One, to refer to a Jewish follower of Jesus, like me, like you said. We might be in a church. We might be in a Messianic congregation. We might observe the seventh-day Sabbath. We might not, but we're Jewish believers in Jesus, so we're called Messianic Jews, because often when you say Christian, that means you belong to another religion, or it means you're no longer Jewish. So that's why we often identify as Messianic Jews. There's another term, another usage of Messianic Jew, which means someone who goes to a Messianic Jewish congregation. So there are two different usages. One is more specific. One is talking about a Jewish believer who's part of a Messianic Jewish congregation. That's fine. So two different meanings, but all talking about Jews. What do you do if you're a Gentile attending a Messianic Jewish congregation? Actually, the great majority of those who attend Messianic Jewish congregations are Gentiles in most parts of America. Here and there, you'll get one that's not like that, but the vast majority are Gentiles attending these. Well, the smiling term we have is Messianic Gentile. I'd be a Messianic Jew. They'd be a Messianic Gentile. In other words, they are Gentiles who follow Jesus the Messiah, but they don't like a lot of church stuff. They feel a lot of human traditions came in, and they prefer worshiping in a Messianic synagogue. Great, fine, wonderful. And there's nothing that says you can't observe the seventh-day Sabbath or you have to worship on a Sunday. Nothing in the Bible that says that. And if they want to keep food laws because they like to, fine. That's fine. But just don't call yourself a Jew. If they say they're Messianic Jews, they're confused. If they say they're obligated to observe the Torah, they're confused. If they say, oh, no, no, we're part of a Messianic Jewish congregation, we call ourselves Messianic Gentiles, we're Messianics. That's how we refer to ourselves. We're Messianics. Instead of saying Christian, we use a synonym, Messianic. And it's the same kind of concept. And we go to a Messianic congregation, and we love it. We really like the teaching there. We like the Jewish root stuff. Great, fine, wonderful. If they say they're Jews, or if they say they're obligated to keep the Torah, then they're confused.
Okay, I was just confused because I saw a picture, and they had their son bar mitzvah, and I was like, wait a minute. I mean, he's not Jewish. So I don't know if, can a Christian become Jewish? Not leaving Christianity, but can, if for some reason I wanted to study Judaism? I mean,
You can study Judaism, but to convert to Judaism would mean a denial of Jesus if you did it in a traditional way. But listen, Christy, stay right there. Betsy's going to get your info. I want to send you a free gift. It's my book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. 60 questions Christians ask about Jewish beliefs and practices. And there's a section in there that you'll find very relevant, the last quarter of the book in particular. All right? So stay right there. Betsy will get your info. Friends, be sure to visit the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and check out our special resource offer. You can download 24 hours of teaching I've done on spiritual warfare, angels, demons, and deliverance, bursting with scripture and scriptural application. $15 just to download 24 hours, and it's yours to keep. Do that at Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. My bottom line today, it is one thing to stand with the Jewish people and love Israel. It is another thing for a Gentile to claim to be a Jew and feel obligated to keep the law of Moses. from Jewish extremists to Jewish Arab reconciliation to Iran to your Jewish calls. We've got you covered today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, thank you for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. I had some very, very interesting calls in the first hour. We'll just say that. Some excellent calls and one that was very interesting. And the number to call to get on the broadcast with any Jewish-related questions. So it can relate to Israel. It can relate to Judaism. It can relate to Jewish background, to the New Testament, Messianic prophecy, Hebrew question. Or if you're a Jewish person and you don't believe in Jesus, want to tell me why? Same number to call, 866-348-7884. All right. If you didn't hear the news, Gay Pride event in Jerusalem today, an ultra-Orthodox Jew who had stabbed participants at the parade in 2005, just released after 10 years in jail. And according to reports, same man stabbed at least six people, at least one of them seriously injured. Of course, he was tackled and arrested by police. He thinks he's doing God's service. I deplore the Gay Pride event in Jerusalem. I deplore all the more someone deciding that they are now going to act on this and try to kill marchers because they feel this is an abomination. It's similar to killing an abortion doctor when you say, well, what he's doing is evil and wrong, and we're going to take the law in our own hands and kill him. No, you don't do that. You don't overcome evil with evil. You don't overcome wrong with wrong. You overcome evil with good. You overcome wrong with right. And anyone who's listened to me, be it for a day or for a month or for a year or a decade or 20 or 30 or 40 years, will know that under no circumstances do we ever condone violence in the name of doing God's work, be it the work of conversion, be it the work of standing for morality. We're not talking about a war. If radical Muslims invaded our country, do we fight back? Of course we fight back. Of course our government fights back. Of course our soldiers fight back. We're not talking about that. We're talking about you do not do evil in the name of God. You do not commit acts of violence in the name of God, thinking you're doing God's service. Well, these people are pagans, so we'll kill them. Well, these people don't believe as we do, so we'll torture them. That is ugly. That is deplorable. That is the flesh. That is the devil. Whether it's the Catholic Church with inquisitions and torturing so-called heretics, whether it's Muslims beheading so-called Islamic apostates, whether it's a religious Jew stabbing someone at a gay pride event, whether it's a Christian killing an abortion doctor. Now, they're not all the exact same act, but without question, all of those actions are deplorable and inexcusable. Somebody had the gall to post this on Facebook. We just discovered it, and this person's post is deleted, and then they'll be blocked. I had posted a comment saying that if you're pro-life, you don't kill abortion doctors, and if you're pro-morality, you don't stab gay pride marchers. Someone had the audacity to post, don't discourage people from killing abortion doctors. While it may be a crime, it is not immoral or possibly unnecessary. If a man puts a sword to 10,000 babies, his death is more Christian than his life. Don't encourage people to kill abortion doctors either. If it's God's will, your voice should not interfere. If someone does kill an abortion doctor, we must show support because he's not a murderer but a wrongfully incarcerated soldier. This is war, folks, and you can't fight demons with Buddhist ideals. Once we discovered that post, we blocked that person from posting again. No one's going to use our Facebook page to condone violence. And those that posted saying, hey, look, I understand it's an abomination, but the guy did in Jerusalem was not bad, they're instantly deleted. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Come on, with that foot tapping there. Well, it's just an automatic reaction from me, tapping feet to Paul Wilbur. Shouts of joy and victory resound in the tents of the righteous of the Lord. 866-34-TRUTH. This is Michael Brown. You are listening to The Line of Fire on a thoroughly Jewish Thursday. My delight to speak with you. Let's go back to Iran. Let's go back to Iran. There was a very interesting article a couple days back in the New York Post by John Podoretz, why the Iran deal's public support is plummeting. And what's fascinating here, and again, you've got a Jewish-related question for me. By all means, give me a call, 866-34-TRUTH. Very, very fascinating. John Podoretz reports that on Tuesday, CNN released a poll showing opposition to the Iran nuclear deal at 52% and support at 42%. This is after the president has passionately defended it. Secretary of State Kerry has passionately defended it. This came on the heels of last week's Pew poll that showed 48% opposition and 38% support. So both the opposition and the support went up. Now, John Podoretz says, as I said last week, it is a historical anomaly for the public to oppose an international agreement of this sort in this way. One example, in 1979, an NBC News Associated Press poll showed an astonishing level of support, 81%, if you can believe it, for the proposed SALT II treaty in the wake of the negotiations between President Jimmy Carter and Soviet Premier Leonid Brezhnev. Anyway, Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, end of the year, and so much for the SALT treaty. But here's something remarkable, Podoretz says. The Israel Project released a poll on Tuesday of 1,000 American Jews. The complex poll conducted by Olive Tree Strategies had three different results. Initially, before any other questions were asked about the Iran deal, Jews opposed it 45% to 40%. But then the poll went through a series of six talking points about specific agreements in the deal. For each of these six talking points, it used the administration's language to defend those points and provide a dispassionate rendering of the opposition's arguments against it. After going through the six talking points, opposition to the deal rose to 51% to 35%. In other words, here's the basic question. You know, do you support the deal with Iran? No. 45% no. 40% yes. This is a Jewish response. Obviously, others uncertain. Then they say, okay, here are the main points. Here's the administration's argument. Here's the counter. So just back and forth, not favoring either side. After getting more information, Jewish opposition, remember, Jews don't vote as heavily democratically as African Americans do, but Jews vote very, very largely Democrat. It's mainly the religious Jews and very, very conservative Jews that vote Republican. Otherwise, Jews for many years now have voted overwhelmingly democratically, all right, as opposed to for Republicans. Yet, Jews oppose the deal 51% to 35 after going through the six talking points. Then a third series of questions designed to gauge levels of concern on points raised against the deal led to a final result in which American Jews opposed it 58% to 30%. That's almost 2-to-1 opposition from Jews who are largely pro-democratic. So it's really, really remarkable. Pew, similar results. When Pew asked the question, without embellishment, so without trying to slant it one way or another, the result was 48% to 38% against. When CNN asked it without embellishment, 52% to 42%. When the Israel Project asked it without embellishment, 45% to 40. What would happen to those other percentages, 48 to 38, 52 to 42, if they had the further details? The opposition would be absolutely massive, which means the more the more people know about the deal, the more opposition there is to it. 866-34-TRUTH. Let me read this from JNN News Update from Barry and Batya Siegel in Israel. This is a news update from yesterday. Neville Chamberlain, all over again. This is from Israel National News. The Neville Chamberlain story has been used appropriately and astutely in regards to the Obama-Kerry deal with Iran. Who was Neville Chamberlain? He served as British Prime Minister from 1937 to 1940. He signed the Munich Agreement in 1938, surrendering the Sudetenland to the, I said it wrong, to the Nazis as a means of appeasement. He believed war should be avoided at all costs, much as President Obama espouses. Indeed, the president is frighteningly similar to Neville Chamberlain in many ways. Just as Chamberlain scaled back the military as Germany was advancing theirs, so too is the president. Chamberlain said, quote, the longer the war is put off, the less likely it is to come at all. Both the president and his secretary of state have stated and intimated that it is this deal with Iran or war. Kerry said, this is a good deal for the world. Chamberlain said the deal with Germany would lead to peace for our time. In Vienna, Secretary of State Kerry said that, I went to war and it became clear to me that I never wanted to go to war again. That's what this is all about, trying to settle these matters through diplomacy and peaceful means. Chamberlain wrote to his sister that, quote, Hitler definitely liked me and thought he could do business with me. Kerry must have the same notion about the Iranians. William Manchester wrote about Chamberlain, quote, more than any man except Hitler, and Hitler could not have done it without him. Chamberlain was responsible for the transformation of Germany into the most powerful military state in Europe. It is eerily similar to what is now happening to Iran thanks to the president and his secretary of state. Iran is being transformed into a superpower by America's very own leaders. Chilling. And I say, honestly, it is very, very difficult to support, very, very difficult to support this deal. And I hope Congress is able to shoot it down. Highlights from the Elav conference in Israel. This is an annual youth conference. It draws hundreds and hundreds of young believers together in Israel, followers of Jesus, the Messiah. Several hundred Jewish, Arab, and Palestinian youth gathered together for Elav in Jerusalem. And what happens there? They wash each other's feet. They love on each other. They pray for each other. They bless each other as Jews, as Arabs, as Palestinians who have one thing in common. That is their faith in Jesus, the Messiah. I'm just looking at a report, one of the speakers there, at the end of my message, I showed a paper which had been distributed on the Temple Mount, claiming to be put out by ISIS and saying that the Arab Christians in Jerusalem needed to leave or risk death by the end of Ramadan, the Muslim fast which ended a few days after Elav. I asked some Jewish Messianic youth to stand on one side and some young Arab believers to stand on the other side. I then asked that Jews would link arms around each Arab and that Arabs would link arms around each Jew. And then for the international youth to stand with both to represent that we would commit to stand with one another should they experience persecution, even to the point of opening our homes if they had to leave theirs, and to lay down our lives for one another if necessary. You don't hear that reported a lot, do you? Yeah, this is reconciliation. This is the gospel. This is how the gospel brings Jew and Gentile together. Two of our staff, Yoel, Jewish, and Melad, Arab, shared how the Lord had recently challenged them as friends as to whether they would commit to the ultimate test of laying down their lives for each other if needed. It was a powerful moment in the Holy Spirit. You can see a video excerpt of this evening above. Let's see if we can post some of this to bring encouragement. This took place earlier this month in Jerusalem. It's so wonderful to hear Jews and Gentiles coming together as one, in particular here, Arabs, Israelis, Palestinians, and Jews coming together as one. Young people who say we want peace with one another, we want to walk in love towards one another, we want to honor our Messiah. 866-34-TRUTH. Oh, let me just take a quick look on Twitter to see here. Let's just see here. I post it. If you're pro-life, you don't murder abortion doctors. If you're pro-morality, you don't stab people at a gay pride march. I'm getting retweeted and favorited it. But no nasty comments here in a little while. Let's just look over on Facebook and see any ugly comments there in response to this post. If they're there, I don't see them. Maybe the hostile, hateful ones have gotten a little tired and dropped out. We'll just let the truth stand unopposed for a little while. We'll come right back with your Jewish-related calls right here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Jesus from Nazareth, son of David. That is Chazakim singing those words, Yeshua Minotzrat ben David. Yeshua the Messiah. This is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Welcome to the broadcast, Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to our old friend Mendel in Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, Michael. I have a few news items to mention to your audience, especially the big one of how the time of the redemption has now come. I'll get to that hopefully in a minute or so. But I just want to make some statements about what they can find on Chabad.info.com. There's a video of a person who was a missionary, and 20 years ago, he came in the dollar line to ask for a blessing from the Lubavitch Rebbe, the King Messiah, and had a book with him that he wrote. And he said to the Rebbe, he said, "I am a Christian." And he said, "And I wrote this book so that I can show it to others." And so he said that he had been born Jewish, and the Rebbe asked him some questions. I think one of them was, "Did you ever go to a synagogue?" And he said no. And this fellow was from Europe. You can hear it by his accent. So he gave the book to the Rebbe, and he asked the Rebbe to pray for him. And so the Rebbe took the book from him, and as the person walked away, the Rebbe took that book and threw it in a brown bag and said...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw the video, but go ahead.
By doing this, you won't be able to influence others in this fashion, in effect, is what he said. Now, on that website, Chabad.info.com, you can see what happened to him in the 20 years since that event. He was sitting there with talis and tefillin on, davening, saying the Shema. And, of course, that is a tremendous sign of how much effect the Rebbe had on him and has on millions of others.
You know what's really interesting? You know what's really interesting, though? I've heard the exact opposite stories, face-to-face or over the phone, in particular over the phone, from people who were raised Lubavitch and who are now fervent followers of Jesus the Messiah. And you'd be stunned by their stories. And I've spoken with them directly, sir. So they heard the Rebbe. They sat under him. They knew him when he was alive, and they've discovered the real Messiah, Jesus Yeshua. So that's
okay. Well, we know now that the time is coming for the final redemption, and as much as there, of course, the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Babitra movement, said that 5,775, the year that we're in now, is going to be the Kate, the time when everything is going to come to its fruition.
So tell you what. Why don't you tell us exactly what's supposed to happen this year? So when it doesn't happen the way you're saying, then at least we'll have it on record. And if it does happen the way you're saying, then people can say, "Wow, this guy Mendel was really having some accurate information." Tell us exactly what is going to happen this calendar year. So you're saying by the end of next September. What's the exact time frame?
Well, there's one sage who is giving a time that it is going to be September the 12th, which would be a Shabbos, and that is what we call Motzei Shviyas, the end of the sabbatical year. And you may have had some discussion on your program, I don't know, about the Shemitah. And that, if you have, then I don't have to go into what that's all about.
Yeah, but if, oh, sure, we've talked about that.
Okay, well, people want to find this video where Reb Chaim Kanievsky says it's going to be Motzei Shvius, and that refers to September the 12th. They can go to realbiblecodes.com.
That's but hang on, what exactly is going to happen? Just because not everyone that's listening on the radio is going to be able to do that. What exactly is going to happen?
Okay, well, it would be Glazerson and then Kanievsky on YouTube. You could find it. Okay, so what's going to happen is that the world is not going to come to an end. In Judaism, we don't have such a concept of apocalypse, where the world is going to have to be destroyed and only the favored ones are going to go up in a rapture and they will be saved, but all the rest will. We have the promise of the prophets that those who keep the Torah and those who repent will be all saved. In fact, the Rebbe tells us that this time around, unlike the
Hang on, what's going to happen September 12th?
What is going to happen then is we're going to be ushered into the new era, the Messianic era, when Lubavitcher Rebbe will be showing himself revealed once again.
So September 12th, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who died at the age of 92 in 1994,
I don't think it's going to be exactly on that date.
Oh, okay, in September.
Well, what the Rabbi Kanievsky has said.
What are you saying is going to happen this calendar year for sure?
Okay.
This Jewish calendar year for sure. Okay. You're saying for sure the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who died in 1994 at the age of 92, will show himself alive, right? And will usher in an age of peace on the earth and this destruction of the wicked. I guess it's going to be the Messianic era, according to you, the rebuilding of the temple, the full gathering of the exiles, and then a time of peace on earth for all who will repent. That's basically what's going to happen?
Well, with one small correction, the Rebbe never died. He was revealed, then concealed, and will be revealed again.
So in other words, the doctors pronounced him dead and he was buried. That was all just a deception.
No. Well, actually, what Rashi says is, in the case of the Gemara and Tainus, he says, Nidma lahem. It appeared to them that Yaakov died.
So when the doctors pronounced him dead, when he had that stroke and could not communicate, was completely incapacitated, and the doctors pronounced him dead, all life symptoms ceased, and he was physically buried in the ground, that was all a test because he didn't really die, according to you, and that he never really died, so he will reveal himself again. Just want to get this clear. So are you saying, just to be clear so that we can once and for all settle this, by the end of September, the whole world will know that Lubavitcher Rebbe is alive and is the Messiah. So we give you a little wiggle room. You said September 12th, that the whole world will know that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is really the Messiah, that he will be revealed to the whole world, and that he will usher in the Messianic era in no uncertain terms. And it won't just be a matter of you claiming it happened and the whole world saying it didn't happen. You claiming that he's alive and well, and the whole world not seeing it. So tell you what, you've put it out there for us. Okay, I got a break coming out. You put it out there for us, folks. I declare categorically that although Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Lubavitcher Rebbe, was one of the greatest Jewish leaders of the 20th century, perhaps the most influential of all, he was categorically not the Messiah. Jesus Yeshua is the Messiah. And hopefully, Mendel, you'll finally recognize the dates aren't coming to pass. It's not a matter of deception. He did die, and his death was not an atonement for the sins of the world. However, the death of Jesus, the Messiah, was an atonement for the sins of the world. And there's no salvation outside of him. I appeal to every Jew, to every Gentile listening, turn to God, to the one living true God, and ask him to open your eyes to the truth about who the Messiah really is. Mendel, you pray that prayer, right? God, show the whole world who the Messiah really is. I pray that prayer right now.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the line of fire. Michael Brown on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thanks for joining us. You might say, what was that call just about? Well, there are traditional Jews who believe that in every generation there is a potential Messiah. In every generation there is a potential Messiah. In other words, he's not going to come down from the clouds, but in every generation there is a Jewish leader who could potentially be the Messiah. Now, I don't hold to this personally, but this is what traditional Jews often believe. And they believe, this is not universally, but many believe this, that if the people of that generation will be worthy, if the Jewish people will rise to a high enough level of spirituality and Torah observance, then this person will be revealed as the Messiah. And then that person will accomplish various things, rebuilding the temple, regathering the exiles, fighting the wars of the Lord, leading the Jewish people into obedience to the Torah, both written and oral, meaning Jewish tradition as well. And as that person does it, then the Jewish world will recognize this truly is the Messiah. Now, I don't believe that is supportable scripturally. You can support some of it scripturally, but certainly not all of it. But there are traditional Jews who believe that. So to say that Rabbi so-and-so could have been the Messiah is a Jewish way of saying he was that great a leader. And if that generation had been worthy, he would have been recognized as the Messiah. Again, I don't hold to this. This is a traditional Jewish teaching. There are those, however, who've gone even further. In other words, not simply saying our deceased great leader could have been the Messiah if the generation had been worthy, but it wasn't, therefore he was never revealed as the Messiah, but rather to say, no, our great leader really was the Messiah and really is the Messiah. You say, well, how come more of them don't believe that? Well, because they'd recognize if the person died before completing their mission, they weren't the Messiah. It's the standard argument that's given against Jesus. Well, he died before completing his mission, therefore he can't be the Messiah. Well, in this case, dying was part of his mission to make atonement for our sins as a priestly Messiah. And by rising from the dead, he continues with his mission to this day. But traditional Jews don't believe that. They don't believe in their Messiah dying before he completes his mission or living on spiritually to complete the mission or something like that. So if someone that they hail as the Messiah dies and has not completed the Messianic mission, even if they believed that person was the Messiah, they say, well, he could have been, but we weren't worthy or we were wrong. There are some, though, who continue to believe. So the followers of Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who many argue was the most significant Jewish leader of the 20th century and the most influential in terms of bringing Jewish people into obedience to Jewish tradition and whose movement continues to grow and spread around the world. If you're in Israel, you'll see all these signs welcoming him as Melech HaMashiach, King Messiah. You'll see in some of their synagogues that they pray prayers, long live King Messiah, to him. And they claim that his physical death was just a test to see if they would really believe or not, and that if you look in his coffin, you'll see he's not there. Now, the Jewish world outside of their particular sect completely rejects that. Even those who honor him, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, called the Rebbe just being a name that's used for the leader of a Hasidic sect, the great leader of their sect, the grand rabbi. But In point of fact, they still believe he is the Messiah. The Jewish world as a whole rejects that. The great majority of those within that sect will not publicly say that they believe he's the Messiah. The tiny remnant says, oh, we all know it. They're just not willing to say it. One thing we know is, however significant a leader he wasn't the Messiah. The Messiah's come and the Messiah's returning. That's the one thing that's sure.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Middle Eastern music reminds us it is thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. If you've got a Jewish-related question or comment, something related to Israel, even something related to Islam, can't guarantee I can answer all Islamic-related questions. Well, can't guarantee I can answer all Jewish-related questions either, but we'll do our best. Hebrew question, or if you're a Jewish person that doesn't agree with me about the Messiah, by all means, give us a call. If you're a Christian that doesn't agree with our stand on Israel, by all means, give us a call. 866-34-TRUTH. Someone was asking me about this the other day on social media, and in fact, it's a question that comes up a lot. A question that comes up a lot. What about these ultra-Orthodox Jews, these men in the black coats, black hats, long beards, side curls, ultra-Orthodox Jews who oppose the modern state of Israel? What about them? What about them? Why do they oppose the state of Israel? And what does this say to Jews as a whole worldwide? The group that's most outspoken is a very tiny group. You're talking about thousands of people called Nitarei Karta. It's an Aramaic term which means guardians or keepers of the city. Nitarei Karta. And they are based mainly in Jerusalem and in Brooklyn. And they vehemently oppose the modern state of Israel. They vehemently oppose it. They believe it is a stumbling block and it is getting in the way of the work of the Messiah. That's what they believe. And they've even gone to Iran to participate in conferences there, and they have been renounced by Jews around the world for doing that very thing. Who are they? Who is Nitarei Karta? And why do they hold to these particular beliefs? It's important to understand that the early Zionist movement at the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s, and then leading up to the formation of the modern state of Israel, that the modern Zionist movement was largely opposed by religious Jews worldwide. Not universally, but largely. Why? Well, one thing was they believed that it was the Messiah who would reestablish the Jewish people in the land. In other words, they were in exile under divine judgment, and when the Messiah came, he would be the one to regather them. To seek to regather themselves would be to get in the way of the work of redemption, try to speed it up. It would be like Christians saying, okay, if Jesus has to die on the cross, let's why don't we encourage him to be crucified when he's 6 years old? No, that would be completely contrary to the plan and will of God for many obvious reasons. They believed it's up to the Messiah to rebuild the temple. They also looked and saw that most of the early Zionists were very secular, that most of the early Zionists were not religious Jews at all. And they thought the worst thing of all would be a modern state of Israel that was secular, because for them, Israel was to be a religious Jewish state, an observant state. In other words, just like the ancient nation of Israel and the Sinai covenant, that here too, these modern Israelis should be living under this covenant, the Sinai covenant, and in keeping with Jewish tradition added to it. So to have a secular Jewish state, they thought would be the worst thing, and Jews raised in it would be encouraged to be secular. They felt it would inflame worldwide anti-Semitism, and they felt that it would hinder the work of the Messiah because he's supposed to regather, and now you're doing a regathering. So based on that, many rabbis, ultra-Orthodox rabbis worldwide, opposed it. There were some who recognized it as a good thing and a positive thing and part of the end-time work of redemption. And then with the reestablishment of the State of Israel after the Holocaust, Jews now having a safe place to live, where they would not be exterminated, where they would have a place of refuge if someone was trying to exterminate them, that then was part of the Jewish population, the religious Jewish population, growing and expanding in Israel to the point that maybe ultra-Orthodox Jews or approaching maybe 15% of the Jewish population of Israel because of their rapid, rapid growth. So among them, there are many who are ambivalent. They are not bashing the modern state of Israel. They are not praising it. They live there, and it is a place where they can focus on study of Torah and keeping the commandments, and they do it. There are others, Niturei Karta and some other groups like Satmar Hasidim, who are especially based in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and in upstate New York and Kiryat Yoel, that remain militantly opposed to the modern state of Israel. But they oppose the Niturei Karta as being too extreme and as siding with the anti-Semites in certain ways. And then there are those that do believe that this is part of the work of the Messiah, part of the work of redemption to bring the Jewish people back, the Gula, the redemption, and that with this, it is hastening the return of the Messiah. But Jews that are not ultra-Orthodox despise Niturei Karta. They feel that these groups work with the worst of anti-Semites, that they fuel the fire of anti-Semites, and that they are being very disloyal to their own Jewish people in doing so. So that's the background as to who they are and to why these things are controversial. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Fort Worth, Texas. John, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Sure thing.
I have a question about the Jewish flag or the symbol that is on the flag. You know, you have some that say that it's the Star of David, and I'm curious to know what biblical proof there is of that you know that David even had a star. And then there are some that say that that's a hexagram, which is a symbol that is needed in order to perform any successful ritual that deals with demonology. So I would like to hear some comments concerning that symbol.
Yeah, the truth is somewhat in between. Certainly, for sure, there's nothing that can connect it to King David whatsoever. To refer to it as the Star of David is just a term, but for sure, there's no connection between David and that star that we have. Now, maybe he knew about it, but there's no evidence for it. There is zero evidence, according to all that I know about it, to that image, that star, going back to King David or being something that was associated with him in a positive way. No evidence that I know of it whatsoever. It's just a term to call it the Star of David. That's one thing. Secondly, it has been used by many different groups, including satanic groups. It has been used over the years by different groups, but that doesn't mean that the symbol itself is an evil symbol. It's had a Jewish history as well as representing the Jewish people. So, for example, when I was in India the first time, I thought I saw anti-Semitism all over because I saw the swastika, the Nazi swastika, all over the place. What I didn't know is that the Nazis got it from India, that it's a Hindu symbol, just meaning good luck or fortune. So it's not a godly symbol, but it had nothing to do with Nazism. It had nothing to do with nationalism. It had nothing to do with Jew hatred. It simply was a symbol going back to Hinduism, having to do with good fortune, good luck. And then the Nazis took it over and modified it a little bit and made it their symbol. So there are certain symbols that have been used by different groups over the years. And unless you could demonstrate that this was originally a satanic symbol and that it has some kind of satanic power, all it is a symbol. And different groups have used it, and Jews have used it for centuries, hence its presence on the Israeli flag. So the symbol itself is neutral. It's been used by different groups, including Satanists, including Jews, but it's best known as a Jewish symbol. And that's why Jews who were persecuted in Nazi Germany had to wear the yellow star, something that even goes back to so-called Christian persecution of Jews when they had to live in basically ghetto situations, and they too had to wear a yellow star. So that's the truth about it, all right?
I really appreciate your comment. Thank you.
Yes, sir. You are very, very welcome. And look, there's some who say, well, no, it should never be used because it's used by Satanists. The thing itself is not satanic. The thing itself does not have satanic power. The thing itself is an image, and it's been used by different groups, and that's just where I leave it. All right. I don't have time to get a call right now. 866-34-TRUTH. Be sure to visit the website, AskDrBrown.org. Check out latest articles. Check out latest videos. We've got some powerful testimonies we posted on video and some of the audio from our show we posted on the YouTube channel. And we've got a really neat special offer this week, a terrific download with 24 hours of teaching for a price that's so low it feels funny to even mention it on the air. Go to the website, AskDrBrown.org. Check out the special offer, and you will be blessed. Hopefully we can be a blessing to you. All right, we'll be right back.
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go over to Richmond, Virginia. Nachum, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Nachum, Ken, nice to talk to you, Dr. Brown.
Thank you.
I was listening to your explanation about the Jewish flag to the gentleman caller a little while ago.
Yes, sir.
And you said there was no background to King David on that?
Yeah, there's no clear evidence that can tie this in. We have no clear archaeological textual evidence that ties this Star of David, this image, back to King David. Now, are you going to refer to some Jewish traditions that would say otherwise, sir?
I believe so. I used to live in Haaretz, and I was always taught that it represented, it's called Matan David, the shield of David, also the star
right.
of David, because the Hebrew letter Dalet, when written in the old form, going ancient, was almost like a triangle. And
right.
in the day when the kings used to go into battle, they would have their initials on their shield. Like if you were King Michael, your M, the first and last letter of your first name, were on your shield, like an M and an L, and it would be designed on your shield to let the enemy know. These are the armies, these are the fighters of Melech David or Melech Michael,
yeah,
King
yeah.
Michael, coming to fight the battle. And if you take the two dalets and you turn them upside down, the two triangles, you get the Ma'agan David. And that was,
yeah, no, I appreciate that.
And that's what I've always learned historically, having lived in Jerusalem. And now I'm not disagreeing with you, sir. I'm not disagreeing with you, sir, about textual or archaeological evidence linking that actual symbol to Melech David, because I don't know of any. Actually.
No. That's just a Jewish.
I agree with you 100%.
Right.
You know, I don't. I've never read any. I've never studied any. I've never seen any. So, hands-on evidence. No, I don't.
No, it's purely right. It's purely tradition. In other words, what you were taught was someone trying to figure this out or to trace it back. And the ancient Hebrew script, which was borrowed from the Phoenicians, the Paleo Hebrew script, a Dalet looked somewhat like a triangle or sitting on its side.
No, it really looked like, if you've seen it. Well,
no, I studied it. I've got a doctorate in Semitic languages, so of course
I
learned the Paleo Hebrew script.
Of course.
Right. So the point is, right, and then you have it where it looks like a triangle with a little line coming out of it.
Right.
We have an old Aramaic script. But the point is, it is just tradition. It is a man-made, the whole thing you just explained is a purely man-made tradition. In other words, it's reconstructing it. It's putting something back that never existed. So, Nahum, if you'll take a minute and get online and just look up Magen David or Star of David or things like that on just any reputable site that'll give you information, you'll realize that the Star of David, in terms of its connection to the Jewish people, is relatively recent. So this is just a way, it's like an archaeological midrash is what someone gave you. It is putting something back that didn't happen. It would be like me telling a story about how Paul was using the King James Bible in his day, you know, reconstructing it. So we're clear on that. Listen. Yeah, I've got to run to another call, but Nahum, thank you for calling. And so what he just shared, not disagreeing with me, but he shared a Jewish tradition he learned while in Israel, which is fascinating, trying to say how this symbol came about, but there's no archaeological or textual evidence for it. It's simply a fascinating tradition. So thank you, sir, for calling in. I really appreciate that. And maybe another day I'll hear more about your background, what got you to Israel to live there. Ba'aretz, those years. All right, got time for one more call. Wayne in Richmond, Virginia, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. So good to talk with you. I am grateful for your ministry. Thank you for what you're doing, and I speak blessing over all that you do.
Well, thank you, sir.
My question is this. One day after my 60th birthday, after a genealogical search, my wife and I discovered my family roots in Germany and discovered that my mother was born in Israel. I have no more information than that. So with that, where do I stand? Where do I go?
Wow. All right, so born in Israel, presumably Jewish, unless there's some Arab blood. I mean, what do you know about the Jewishness of it? Anything?
No, sir. What I told you is all that I have found out.
How about name? Do you know what her maiden name was at birth?
Yes, I do. It was Ursula Maria Katharina Horn.
Ah, okay. Well, technically...
That's a lot more like German than Israeli.
Yeah, but why was she born in Israel? Now, you know, so... Obviously, they're choices. I mean, she could have been born of Christian missionary parents that were there. She could have been working in the land for other reasons. It's obviously the whole first three names certainly don't sound Jewish. What you could do, there in Richmond, we had a call earlier from a fellow who's with a group called Lubavitch, okay? And Lubavitch, those are Hasidic Jews. You'll find them under Chabad, C-H-A-B-A-D. And they're very big into genealogy and things like that. Now, if in fact she was born in Israel, forget where she was born. If in fact she was Jewish, then according to Jewish tradition, you have Jewish blood as well. All right, so that would make you a Jewish follower of Jesus according to Jewish tradition, even though you were raised without knowing it. What you could do is just be totally honest with them. Tell him, listen, you're a Christian, I presume, yes?
Yes, 18 years.
Yeah, okay. And say, listen, I'm a Christian. All my life I understood I was Gentile, but I just found out my mother was born in Israel. Is there any way to find out if she was Jewish? Now, their incentive will be, okay, she's Jewish, you need to practice Judaism. If that's the case, give us a call, we'll help you out. But they may be able to just give you a little information as to how to look beyond that. I don't know. You know, the name itself is not telling me anything except raising more questions. But you may check with them. But just be straightforward. Say, hey, I'm a Christian. As far as I know, Gentile, but I just found out what I found out. Can you help shed any light on this? I'm curious. And then if they determine your mother was Jewish and they try to get you to practice Judaism, you can say, hey, thanks. I mean, I'm happy to meet with you guys, but I'm a follower of Jesus. All right. I appreciate the call. Remember to visit the website, askdrbrown.org. Check out this week's special resource offer and be ready with your questions for tomorrow's broadcast. My bottom line today, as we look at the violence that took place in Jerusalem today, we don't overcome hatred with hatred and violence with violence. We overcome what's wrong by doing what's right.